Says Laura Basta, head of fitness at Sydney Wellness Boutique, one playground which offers play-dedicated classes from calisthenics to circus fit. Think strength and flexibility with a side of aerial trapezing. People have so much fun, they don't realize they're working out. I mentioned clamoring around the trampoline park with my nephew, which sparks buckets of joy before I even register the sweat-breaking part. You're using different muscle types, gaining coordination and agility. It's about exposing your body to a diverse range of movements. As for truly harnessing the power of play, experiment with different activities to find what lights you up beyond a particular goal, because that's the core of soft fitness, really. More than any specific workout, it's about moving from a place of self-kindness in a way that feels good for you. Sounds like a mindset shift I can totally get on board with. If you want to share Encouragementology with a friend who needs to know they're not alone in this journey of self-discovery, you can visit Encouragementology.com or anywhere you stream your content to receive this episode and all others. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram for additional encouragement throughout the week. So I challenge you, redefine your approach to health by focusing on activities and habits that enhance your overall well-being, not just your appearance. Embrace this holistic perspective to unlock a happier, freer, and more vibrant version of yourself. I know you can do it. Thank you for listening to Encouragementology with Kendall Boyson, where we find positive ways to handle some of life's challenges. I stumbled through until the path was clear. That's when I found you. How I wound up here. Listen, responsive stations count on you, not Arbitron. Their buttons you get, radio that turns you on.
Hi there, this is Ann Feeney, and you are listening to listener-supported community radio, KVU FM in Portland.
Welcome to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a global audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Salwa Khan, producer and host of Mothering Earth, coming to you from Wimberley, Texas. Today on Sprouts, is drinking milk and eating dairy products the best way to get calcium for strong bones and teeth? American children drink gallons of milk in their young lives. Milk is given to kids in schools, and adults are encouraged to drink milk and eat milk products like cheese, yogurt, ice cream, and butter so that they will get enough calcium. Meanwhile, milk consumption in the U.S. has been falling for years, so the federal government props up dairy farmers with billions of dollars in subsidies, otherwise known as taxpayer money, and buys a lot of the excess milk, which is stored as cheese and butter. In addition, millions of gallons of excess milk is dumped by dairy farmers into fields and animal waste lagoons. Still, the dairy industry lobby is working hard to convince us that milk is the best source of calcium. Turns out that's not true. Consider this. Americans consume lots of dairy products, yet suffer from brittle bones and bone loss. Dairy is not great for the environment either. Like the meat industry, it has a significant damaging effect on our water, land, and air. Milk, calcium, bones, and the environment. Let's look at that with Mark Rifkin, who's a registered dietitian and sustainability specialist. starting with the environmental impact of dairy.
In livestock agriculture, the greenhouse gas of most concern is not carbon dioxide, but methane. And methane is about 85 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide is. According to EPA, dairy cows emit almost one-third of all livestock-sourced methane. And most of that is from cow burps, or essentially every time the cow regurgitates its cud. It also emits methane. Unfortunately, a dairy cow may regurgitate cud several hundred times per day. That means a lot of methane. The remaining methane is from manure, much of which is held in the so-called lagoons until it's disposed of, usually by spraying on a crop field. One of these so-called lagoons can easily hold several million gallons of manure, which of course has huge implications for water pollution, even under normal circumstances. But what happens when these lagoons are flooded? Think about all the atmospheric rivers that have hit California in recent months. And the single largest dairy state in the country is, of course, California, with more than 1.5 million dairy cows just in that one state.
A clarification, atmospheric rivers are giant streams of water vapor being blown through the sky. They're close to 400 miles wide and can be more than 1,000 miles long.
Many of these atmospheric rivers hit central California, which is, of course, where the dairy farms are concentrated. So I would think many California rivers are heavily polluted with dairy waste. And dairy, of course, is a huge occupier of farmland, requiring more than 10 times more land per liter of product than that required for any plant milk. So it's basically, environmentally, it's a bad deal all around.
Yet we're continuing to pay for it, right? Through government subsidies?
Among the subsidies include price supports, marketing support, foreign trade support, plus I've already mentioned exemptions from environmental laws. Then, of course, you've got subsidies on the feed that they feed the dairy cows, mostly corn and soybeans. The list literally could go on. Environmentally, the biggest subsidy is regulations not enforced or made subject to the dairy industry. So, you know, if the average industry went and discharged, you know, human waste into a stream, you know, the state would be all over them like brown on rice, unless you happen to be the livestock industry. Then it's pretty much okay. You can pretty much, you know, barring extreme circumstances, you can pretty much do whatever you like. And in many cases, in fact, environmental laws are specifically written to accommodate the livestock industry. So the EPA is only under recent pressure to try to regulate it. But of course, you know, the government is very, very much focused on what it calls voluntary measures. So they're not necessarily focused on requiring the industry or farms to do certain things, but trying to encourage them to do certain things.
Yeah, I wonder how that's going.
One can only imagine.
Can you give us a picture of the life of a dairy cow?
So like any mammal, cows lactate most efficiently after pregnancy. After the baby is removed from being able to nurse, the milk that nature intended for the baby is then diverted for human use. The baby is then usually held in extreme confinement for about 6 weeks, after which it's killed for the veal market. Meanwhile, the mother is producing so much milk, about six times faster than what her biology would normally allow, that the mother's teats are at risk for infection without constant dosing of antibiotics. But the law requires that all milk must not contain any detectable antibiotics when it's sold. So even assuming all milk sold in the U.S. is free of antibiotics, the antibiotics and, unfortunately, antibiotic-resistant bacteria still accumulate in the manure, which then can present problems if that manure is sprayed on vegetable crops, which happens all the time. So unfortunately, even vegans are not immune, shall we say, from exposure to antibiotic antibiotics associated with livestock. Now, this also presents problems when the flies that land on that manure carry those same antibiotic-resistant bacteria to local communities. So even when factory farms comply with the law, they're still a clear and present threat to the public health.
I'm Salwa Khan. I'm here today with Mark Rifkin. He is a registered dietitian and sustainability specialist. And most people have been taught by the dairy industry that they must drink a lot of milk and eat many dairy products to be healthy. As a registered dietitian, what can you tell us about that premise?
Well, even though the dairy industry loves to play the poor, abused victim, the industry and its defenders still have plenty of influence in marketing and government policy. And that's the expected result when Congress and government, which was long dominated by people of Caucasian complexion, set nutrition policy, partly based, of course, on their own perspectives and their own inherent food cultures and biases. But policy still largely reflects the perspective that intake of cow's milk is normal and that those who don't consume it are less than normal, and also at a distinct nutritional disadvantage. So I'd say the disadvantage is similar to that from not consuming dog or deer milk. None of us, I trust, are consuming dog milk. Are we going to suffer from bone loss because we're not consuming dog milk? I don't think so.
This brings us to what's referred to as lactose intolerance, which is when people get digestive upsets from consuming milk or milk products. Most African Americans and people from Asian countries are unable to digest the lactose in cow's milk. What is lactose?
Lactose is the sugar that's in milk. 99% of all lactose in nature is found only in mammal milk. So if someone is lactose intolerant, they've lost the ability to digest lactose, meaning fundamentally that they no longer produce an enzyme called lactase. If they consume enough lactose, the lactose that should have been digested higher in the gut is transported lower down, where will likely cause some degree of digestive upset, including nausea, gas, bloating, or diarrhea.
And why does this happen?
Well, first we have to clarify that what we call lactose intolerance is actually the normal state of adult human biology. In fact, it's the normal state of adult mammal biology. That's because nature programmed mammal babies to lose the ability to digest lactose as a way to push the baby off of mammal milk at the right time in its childhood. Nature wants to do that because it doesn't want the mother to be at risk due to the huge increase in nutritional needs from being both pregnant and nursing at the same time. Nature wants each to happen separately to better regulate birth spacing. So as the baby moves away from mammal milk because it no longer can digest lactose, the mother is then able to reovulate and theoretically become pregnant again. This allows the mother to give birth, nurse, and ultimately succeed, and thus increasing her fertility, which increases the success of the species as a whole. So nature in its wisdom, and I'm constantly amazed that nature is this smart.
So why is it then that Caucasians are not lactose intolerant?
So as it happens, even though the convention is that that those who don't consume milk are abnormal, continued production of the enzyme lactase to digest the sugar lactose, what is known in the literature as lactase persistence. That's the real mutation. There was a mutation about 10,000, well, several mutations that developed around 10,000 years ago. One of these mutations migrated to Northern Europe. So in a time of scarce food and unsafe water, those who can digest something that their neighbors cannot will hold a distinct evolutionary advantage. These newly migrated mutants were able to outcompete the original inhabitants in Northern Europe. Those original inhabitants eventually died out. Advanced to the colonial era, say 300 to 400 years ago, when these Northern European mutants, mostly British, Germans, Irish, Dutch, colonized North America. They brought their mutation and their livestock with them. They then established, of course, the system and the structures which eventually created current nutrition policy. Meanwhile, those mutations never reached Native Americans or most of Africa or most of East Asia. I'd like to say that, you know, if North America had been colonized by the Chinese, very few of us would be consuming dairy.
You're listening to Sprouts, radio from the grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of global interest. I'm Salwa Khan, producer and host of Mothering Earth in Wimberley, Texas. My guest is Mark Rifkin, registered dietitian and sustainability specialist, and we're sorting out what we've been told by the dairy industry about dairy foods and calcium and bones. We're told that dairy is the best and maybe the only really good source of calcium.
Well, I would disagree that dairy is the best source of calcium. The dairy industry wants to define best as containing the most calcium per serving, despite the fact that there is actually one absolute rule in nutrition, and that is more is not necessarily better. More may have no effect, or often more may actually be worse. So this is most especially true for minerals like calcium, nearly all of which have what we call a TUL, or a defined upper intake limit. So additionally, as intake increases, absorption usually decreases. If the body perceives a flood, it generally won't absorb that much. So on the other hand, as intake decreases, absorption increases. So lower calcium intakes may actually provide better absorption. But of course, the industry doesn't want to tell people that. Perhaps the most important point amongst all this is the simplest and definitely one that the dairy industry would also rather have people not recognize, which is that dairy cows are vegan. By all conventional wisdom, they should be osteoporotic because dairy cows don't consume milk. So gosh, where do the dairy cows get calcium? Well, of course, from their diet. They obtain calcium from plants because minerals originate in soil. Period, full stop. That's where calcium comes from. It comes from the soil. So that makes plants the default vehicle of delivery, not mammalian milk. So plant sources of calcium include collard greens, kale, bok choy, almonds, nuts, figs, beans, and of course, any fortified plant food. Of course, collards and kale supply other key nutrients for bone health that milk doesn't, like vitamin K, and collards and kale don't poop. So I would ask the industry, which is the superior calcium source? Not the dairy.
What is it that calcium does in our bodies?
So mostly it's associated, of course, with bone density, but that also includes the health of our teeth. Calcium is also essential for heart function. So, and there's a very narrow range in the bloodstream to maintain proper heart function. It's also essential for muscle contractions, nerve function, transport of various components within cells, production of hormones and hormone-related functions, as well as enzymes.
Americans consume many milk products, such as cheese, yogurt, butter, ice cream, and milk, which we're told builds strong bones. If this is true, then why is it that bone fractures and bone loss is so common?
Unfortunately, the most likely scenarios are either lack of nutrients necessary to absorb calcium, lack of nutrients to deposit in the bones, or other lifestyle factors that increase calcium losses. So if we start with the losses, the most significant factors appear to be high sodium diets, use of tobacco and alcohol, and lack of weight-bearing exercise. That pretty much defines the American lifestyle right there. Nutrient problems include lack of vitamin D, which transports calcium from the gut to the blood, a lack of vitamin K to deliver calcium to the bone. The primary source of vitamin K is green leafy vegetables, which, of course, Americans rarely consume. Who wants to eat green leafy stuff? So ultimately, more than 24 nutrients and lifestyle factors either enhance or deplete bone density. Yet we only hear about calcium and vitamin D. So I compare the current, a balanced picture to, say, a puzzle. And we need all the puzzle pieces in the right balance to make a complete and healthy, puzzle. Piling on multiple copies of one or two pieces of the puzzle doesn't complete an optimal puzzle if the other pieces are not also in place. So we ultimately, the government and the industry are telling us, pile on two pieces of your puzzle, you just forget about the rest.
When I go to my doctor about bone loss, she talks about medication, but not about diet.
We all know that physicians and most other healthcare providers obtain very little actual nutrition education in their training. The last number I saw was 20 clock hours. Not credit hours, but clock hours. 20 hours out of 4 years plus of medical education and training is spent on nutrition. And that's nutrition in general, not specific to, say, bone health. Loss of bone density is not a deficiency of medication. It's due to a deficiency in lifestyle 90% of the time. We need to address it where the problem originated, which is lifestyle. But of course, if your doctor is very concerned about your bone density, they'll prescribe medication. They probably won't talk to you about your diet when the diet is the original cause. And in fact, osteoporosis can be reversed, but doctors then tend not to see that because, as you can tell, that this bone density is not a simple picture to draw, and that the system doesn't really allow for effective nutrition counseling by most healthcare providers.
Is calcium supplementation ever necessary?
Well, one can never say never. So there will always be certain populations who will need some type of supplementation, such as people whose food intake is limited for any reason. An example might be older adults with poor appetites. Another example might be people healing from broken bones. They're probably going to need a little bit more calcium to heal that bone. But for most of us, supplements should be supplemental to a healthy diet. They should not be a replacement for a healthy diet.
Does the supplement actually help build bones?
It could, but it's still one piece of that 29-piece puzzle. So, I mentioned the vitamin K earlier, and we know, we've mentioned vitamin D, we mentioned sodium. Magnesium is another one, also which tends to occur in dark green leafy vegetables, but not the same vegetables that also tend to be good sources of calcium. So while collard greens are a good source of calcium, they don't have a lot of magnesium. For magnesium, we have to go to spinach or Swiss chard. So magnesium is another part of the bone density puzzle, but never hear the dairy industry talk about magnesium. That would be wrong. Omega-3 fats probably play a role in bone density by helping to reduce inflammation. And inflammation is not good for building bone density.
I'm Salwa Khan here with Mark Rifkin, registered dietitian and sustainability specialist. Mark, as we're learning, there's a lot more to bone health than calcium. What are some of the other elements we need, and how do we get them from our diet?
So some of the other elements, again, we've mentioned magnesium, vitamin D, sodium, but vitamin C plays a role. Of course, we only get vitamin C from fruits and vegetables. And frankly, if you dismissed potatoes from the average American diet, the average American probably would get next to no vitamin C. So again, how are they going to build a healthy bone puzzle? Some evidence indicates a role for vitamin E, which of course is only sourced from plant foods. particularly sunflower seeds and spinach, once again. Where's the average American getting vitamin E? I have no idea. They're certainly not eating spinach. Even vitamin A plays a role. So most Americans probably get some vitamin A through foods like sweet potatoes and carrots. You just eat a carrot and dip it in hummus. You'll get a ton of technically you're getting a carotenoid, which your body will convert to vitamin A. But eating a whole carrot will give you enough vitamin A for the entire day. So one other nutrient commonly lost in the bone density picture is iodine, which is the key component of the thyroid hormone. The thyroid hormone is your body's engine to drive metabolism. Where's the average American getting iodine? Well, theoretically, they could get it from iodized salt, but most of the salt that's used as a food ingredient is not iodized. I don't recommend iodized salt as a source of iodine because the sodium cost is too high. You don't get a whole lot of iodine for just a few sprinkles. I would recommend a seaweed called kelp, sometimes called kombu, as the best source amongst seaweed. If for those who don't enjoy sea flavor, you can buy at almost any natural food store or drugstore, buy a kelp tablet. They're inexpensive, they're effective, and they're commonly available.
I'm Salwa Khan, here with Mark Rifkin, registered dietitian and sustainability specialist. And this is something I read recently, which was, I found, just pretty shocking, is that the USDA buys up the excess milk from farmers, which is milk they can't sell, and then they have it made into cheese, and then they sell it at a low cost to fast food chains to add to their products, thereby adding, you know, an unhealthy amount of cheese to already unhealthy fast food, which results in obesity and health issues. Is this something you're aware of, and what is there anything could be done about this?
Well, that's a complex question. So many people are aware of the new model of pizza chains to put cheese in the crust. That was a direct example of this program that you just described. It's called the dairy checkoff. So this could be particularly challenging to stop because the program is not funded directly by taxpayers per se. It's funded through allocation of a portion of the revenue from every sale of fluid milk. However, the program is administered by USDA officials, who are, of course, paid through standard government channels. So these checkoff programs are controversial even within the industry itself, because a lot of producers don't want to have a portion of their sales, you know, taken out of their pocket. But most lawsuits that have challenged checkoff programs have been unsuccessful. The congressional leaders that sit atop the agriculture committees in both houses, they're not exactly, well, particularly in one house, they're not exactly in a rush to, shall we say, strike up a fight with mainstream dairy industry. And of course, as long as consumers continue to buy milk, the program will continue to be funded.
How about a recipe for a calcium-rich meal?
One of my favorites is to build a healthy meal with a lot of bone density important foods, such as a beans and greens stew. So this would start with about 4 cups of raw collard greens or kale and about 1 2/3 cups of any variety of cooked beans or a can of low-sodium beans. So saute the onions in a little oil, add your greens and the water, cook that down for about 10 minutes, add the beans and other vegetables on hand. So that could be mushrooms, bell peppers, carrots, butternut squash, corn, green peas, cauliflower. Cook that for another 5 or 7 minutes and then finish with a combo. It's one of my favorite combos, which is a dash of hot sauce and a drizzle of molasses. So you get sweet and spicy. serve that over a healthy whole grain. My favorite is barley. You could also do brown rice. You could do quinoa or spelt. That would be a healthy meal, especially for bone health.
Thanks so much for listening. And thank you to my guest, Mark Rifkin, who's a registered dietitian, a licensed dietitian nutritionist, and sustainability specialist. Find out more about Mothering Earth at our website, mothering-earth.com. That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Mothering Earth on Dairy and Calcium. I'm Salwa Khan, producer and host. Production assistance came from Robert Curry and VCS Productions in Wimberley, Texas. Additional music is by Jerry Burns. The Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the globe. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to showcase nationally on Sprouts, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. That's ursula@pacifica.org. I'm Salwa Khan in Wimberley, Texas. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934.